All right, let's start Unit 2. The first of the three chapters in the unit has to do with the molecules that organisms are made out of, or some of the molecules, I should say. We've already talked about what kinds of atoms make up organisms. I gave you that table in an earlier chapter. Now it's time to talk about molecules. And any given organism is made up of all kinds of molecules, some of which are just comparatively small, you know, things like water molecules. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking in this chapter about macromolecules, biological macromolecules, which are compared to those run-of-the-mill small molecules like water, very large, meaning they're made up of quite a few atoms. And there are four major categories of biological macromolecules that any organism is made of. They're all indispensably important. You can't do without any of the four. And you might have learned these four categories before. Has anyone ever learned these? Do you know what any of them, any of the categories are?
Lipids,
proteins, nucleic acids, and polysaccharides. Exactly. Now, we're going to survey all of these in this chapter, but let's just look at the list. Lipids, I'm going to call proteins for the moment, polypeptides. Nucleic acids, you said, I'm going to call those polynucleotides. And the fourth was polysaccharides. For the moment, I'll tell you why this is not strictly true later on, but for the moment, I'm going to use polypeptides and proteins more or less interchangeably, meaning the same thing. And polynucleotides is just another name for nucleic acids. If you did learn these four categories in some other course, you might have learned that this one I'm calling polysaccharides was carbohydrates. That even books say this, though it's really not correct. Carbohydrates is a huge set of molecules, not all of which are large. For instance, you built a small carbohydrate, glucose. That's not a macromolecule. So the set of molecules that are carbohydrates should not be one of these four categories of macromolecules. Instead, only the large carbohydrates are macromolecules, and those specifically are polysaccharides, which you make by hooking together small carbohydrates called monosaccharides. All right, that's the difference. But I also use these names in particular because it shows you that using these names shows you that three of these four categories of macromolecules are more specifically, in other words, in addition to being macromolecules, they are officially classified as polymers. All four of these are large molecules, but only three of them are polymer categories. And those are the ones that have poly in the name. Now, the word polymer just means literally many part. Mer means part and poly means many. Polymers are not only large molecules, they are created by hooking together subunits that can be either the same kinds of subunits repeated or different kinds of subunits, but they're all linked together to make the large polymer. Those subunits are called monomers, literally meaning one part, a single subunit, in other words. Well, lipids are macromolecules, but they are not polymers. They're built differently, and we'll see examples of that when we get to the lipid section. This opening slide, though, isn't about any one of the four categories in particular. And even though it says here polymer and monomer, just because of the example that's being used, the important thing about this slide actually applies to all four categories, whether they're polymers or not. Okay, so this is what I'm about to discuss in slide one is true for lipids as well as all the other three. And the point here is that cells are always building large molecules, and they're always breaking larger molecules into smaller molecules as part of their metabolism, as part of living. And building up big molecules out of smaller parts is shown on the top. And 1, 2, 3, these are just chunks. It doesn't matter what those are. But in any of the four categories of molecules, if you're going to build them, you need to hook smaller pieces together. And in any example of that, one of the pieces, you're going to hook two pieces together first. You could do it over and over, but one of the two pieces that you hook together is going to have a hydrogen somewhere hanging off of it, and the other piece is going to have an OH hanging off of it somewhere. And that allows for a place to hook these things together. Because you remove the H from one chunk and the OH from the other chunk, and those two hydrogens and the oxygen come out, hooked together as water. Water gets spit out of this process. And that, if you think of this in terms of ball and stick models, that would allow two unmet bonds to come together, right? You hook the two together to make a bigger chunk. That specific chemical reaction involving the removal of a hydrogen and an OH to form water coming out is called a dehydration reaction. It's called dehydration because water comes out in the process. You're removing water. But that allows you to hook the two chunks together and build something bigger. Some books also use the word, instead of dehydration, the word condensation reaction. Those are completely interchangeable terms. They refer to exactly the same process. But the word dehydration is a little bit better, I think, because it reminds you that water comes out in that situation. So we use dehydration reactions to build bigger molecules. And this is happening all the time in cells as part of metabolism. But the reverse, as I said, also happens. And this is a reversible reaction, meaning you can do exactly the opposite, which is what's shown on the bottom. So now you already have a bigger chunk and you're going to break it into two smaller pieces. You exactly reverse the process. Instead of water coming out, you have to put water in. You have to supply water, which is then going to be split into an H and an OH, so that when you break a bond in this big piece, one of the two pieces is going to get an H and the other one is going to get an OH to satisfy the valence. It's exactly the reverse of dehydration. But we call this hydrolysis. Hydro, of course, is referring to the water. Lysis is a general word that means splitting. So linguistically or literally, it means water splitting, using water to split a big chunk into smaller pieces. All right, that's the general scheme for how these things are built and then torn down. Now let's go to the rest of the chapter, starting with slide 2, which is a one-by-one survey of these four categories of macromolecules. Starting with polysaccharides, even though slide 2 doesn't show you any polysaccharide. None of these is a polysaccharide. They are all carbohydrates. This is the point I was making before. But these are small carbohydrates. These are monomers that could be linked together to make a larger carbohydrate called a polysaccharide, but these are not themselves polysaccharides. They're single units. They're simple sugars. And each of these monosaccharides, and by the way, this is not nearly an exhaustive list of monosaccharides. There are many, many, many different kinds of monosaccharides. Not all that many that organisms have in their bodies, but if you think about it just in chemistry terms, there's really no limit to the number of monosaccharides you could build. Anyway, this is a sampling of monosaccharides. With this sampling, though, you can see something that's true of all monosaccharides, namely what they share, what they have in common. All of them feature what's highlighted here in salmon color, which is what?
A double
bond. Say that in one word. It's a carbonyl group, exactly. All monosaccharides in the linear form, and that's what these are all depicted as, the linear form, have a carbonyl group. including the one you built, glucose, in your ball, with your ball and stick models. The linear form gets its name because the carbon skeleton does not form a ring. In other words, it has tips to it. It doesn't wrap around and form a ring. But, as we'll see in a minute, monosaccharides can exist in either the linear form or the ringed form. These are the linear forms. And in any monosaccharide that's in the linear form, there's a carbonyl group somewhere. All right? Now, what's really illustrated here with this table are two different and fundamentally unrelated ways of categorizing monosaccharides. One way is illustrated with the columns, the other way is illustrated with the rows. So let's look at the columns first. Glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone are in this first column, and notice that they have exactly the same chemical formula, meaning they have exactly the same number of carbons and hydrogens and oxygens. They are both C3H6O3, which is why a chemical formula doesn't really tell you the whole story, right? Because these are what with respect to each other? What is their relationship, glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone?
Hydrocarbons.
No, they're not hydrocarbons. Actually, I'm glad you said that, because before we get back to that question I just asked you, let me just say in general that you should not confuse, I said this before, I think, you should not confuse the word hydrocarbon and carbohydrate. They sound very similar. But hydrocarbons contain only carbon and hydrogen, as we've talked about in the previous chapter. Carbohydrates contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. Moreover, though, they contain those three elements in a specific ratio, depending on how many carbons there are in the skeleton. But the general formula for a monosaccharide is CnH2nOn, meaning there n is however many carbons there are. However many there are, there's that same number of oxygens, and there's twice that number of hydrogens. All right? Now, by analogy with the distributive property of math, you could rewrite this general formula as Cn, and then in parentheses, H2O, with n outside the parentheses. You see how I distributed that? And if you write it this way, it shows you why these things were called carbohydrates. They look like they are carbon and water in some, multiplied by some number. Okay? For monosaccharides. Not all carbohydrates. That applies to monosaccharides only. When you start joining them together, you don't have that same ratio anymore. But these are all monosaccharides. And the word I was looking for the relationship between these two that are in the same column with C3H6O3, is they are isomers of each other. Any two substances with exactly the same chemical formula are isomers, right? So these are different sugars, different substances, but they have the same exact chemical formula. And what they share in this case, in terms of being monosaccharides, is that they have exactly three carbons. So what the columns are illustrating is that you can classify carbohydrates based on the number of carbons in the skeleton. In other words, there are three carbon monosaccharides, there are four carbon monosaccharides, and so on. All right? Well, whenever you see OSE as an ending of a word in chemistry or biology, it's a good indicator that you are looking at a carbohydrate of some sort, whether it's monosaccharide or polysaccharide or somewhere in between. It's a sugar of some sort, usually if it ends in OSE. And tri simply means three. So glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone are examples of a category of monosaccharides called trioses. Triose simply means three-carbon sugar. Okay. Similarly, pentoses are five-carbon sugar, like ribose and ribulose here. Hexoses include the six carbon sugar that you built, glucose, plus a bunch of others. All right, so that's one way of categorizing monosaccharides based on the size of the carbon skeleton. The rows illustrate a completely different way of categorizing that has nothing to do with the first way. And this is where the carbonyl that all linear form carbohydrates share comes into play. So think back to your functional groups and the properties of them. Remember that there isn't just one category of substances that contain carbonyl groups, because there are two possible positions or categories of positions that the carbonyl can occupy in a molecule. Remember talking about this? The carbon that is part of the carbonyl group can either be at a tip of the carbon skeleton or not. And that's why there are two categories of carbonyl-containing compounds. Do you remember what those are?
Aldehydes and ketones.
Aldehydes and ketones. That's where I gave you the hopefully helpful mnemonic of the fact that aldehydes, the word starts with A, which is at a tip of the alphabet, to remind you that a carbonyl-containing compound with the carbonyl carbon at a tip of the skeleton is an aldehyde, not a ketone. If it's not at a tip, then it's a ketone. So sugars, monosaccharides I mean, are either aldehydes or ketones. But they're sugars, so they are aldoses, aldehyde sugars, or ketoses, ketone sugars. That's what the rows are illustrating.
Hydrocarbons, and this slide isn't a hydrocarbon, right?
No, because there's oxygen. Hydrocarbons contain carbon and hydrogen only, like methane and butane and pentane and so on. Okay. Now we can see a picture in slide 3 of this of the fact that any given monosaccharide can exist either in linear form, which we were looking at before, and we can see right here on the left. This is a hexose linear form, or a ringed form. And notice it's shown as a reaction, because to form a ring, you have to take that linear skeleton and make a bond with one of the carbons back onto one of the other carbons to form that ring. And that, if you think about it in terms of molecular modeling, should make sense to you that to do that, you have to break some bonds in order to complete the ring. So it is a chemical reaction, and specifically in this case, the ring is made by hooking carbon 6 to carbon 2, and that in right here, making this bond, carbon 1 and carbon 5 right here and here to make this bond. And carbon 1, of course, is called carbon 1 because it's the one that involves the carbonyl, which has the double bond, right? The only way you can complete this ring is if you get rid of one of those bonds in the double bond to make room for this bond between C and O. Do you see that? And so notice that in the ringed form, a monosaccharide no longer has a carbonyl group. All right? Only linear carbohydrates have a carbonyl group. Now, here's why this is important. We're building up to macromolecules, right, which are polysaccharides. You build a polysaccharide by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides. But you can't hook monosaccharides together unless the monosaccharides are in ringed form. Okay, they can't be in the linear form to hook together. Well, you lose that carbonyl group when you hook them together, because you lose the carbonyl group when you make them into the ringed form. This is why Benedict's test tests for monosaccharides only and not disaccharides or polysaccharides. Because disaccharides and polysaccharides have only ringed form subunits in them. They don't have any carbonyl groups, and the carbonyl groups, remember, are the source. The double bond in the carbonyl is the source for the electron that reduces carbon ions in Benedict's solution to turn it from blue to red. Does all that make sense? But in terms of this chapter, The ringed form and linear form are important because only the ringed form can be used to hook them together to build the bigger carbohydrates that we're building up to, which are the polysaccharides. Okay, we can see that in slide 4 using a couple examples. Now, first of all, appreciate, based on slide 1, that what we're doing when we hook two monosaccharides together is hooking two smaller chunks together to make a bigger chunk. And that, in general, as I said, involves a dehydration reaction. We build bigger things out of smaller things with dehydration reactions. This is no exception. This is just a specific example of that. So as I said, in general, for dehydration reactions, one of the pieces is going to have an OH somewhere, one of the pieces is going to have an H somewhere. Those three atoms get removed as water that comes out, and that allows you to bond the two pieces together. So in the top example, both of the monosaccharides are glucose. It's just two copies of glucose. We hook those together with a dehydration reaction to form the disaccharide, or two-piece sugar, called maltose, malt sugar. Yeah?
So when you said they go into the ring structure, I thought you said they lose the OH, right?
No, they lose the carbonyl.
Oh, carbonyl.
Yes, the C double bond O. Okay, now, this is a dehydration reaction. But when we're using a dehydration reaction specifically to hook two monosaccharides together, as opposed to other subunits that we'll look at that get hooked together for the other molecules, the specific bond that results between two monosaccharides hooked together is called a glycosidic linkage. So that's how you build disaccharides first, and if you keep going, eventually polysaccharides made up of many individual subunits hooked together by forming glycosidic linkages, which form because of dehydration reactions. Well, there are all kinds of different monosaccharides, and therefore there's all kinds of different ways to mix and match them to make all kinds of different disaccharides. Sucrose is just another example of a disaccharide. This one is table sugar that we use for all kinds of things. But that's made by glucose and fructose hooked together rather than two glucoses. Still the same process, though. It's a dehydration reaction. Something loses OH, something loses H. A glycosidic linkage is formed. And there's nothing saying that you have to stop at disaccharide, because you still have H's and OH's available to hook more and more together. That's how you form, eventually, a polysaccharide. While we're still on this slide, though, let me have you notice that even though we have already taken an H and an OH off of the two chunks to make this disaccharide in both of these cases, there are still H's and OH's available, so other connection points can exist for further hooking. And this is why when you build a polysaccharide, it might be or it might not be, depending on how it happens, branched. It's possible for there to be branching because there's multiple OHs available for hooking sites when you add another subunit.
Polysaccharides.
We're building polysaccharides here. But when we get to polynucleotides and polypeptides, you'll see that's not true. Neither of those two has branching. But polysaccharides can. They don't have to, but they can have branching. We'll see a picture of that in a minute. Well, actually, right now. Slide 5. Now we're finally getting to a picture of an actual polysaccharide. The previous slides were just subunits, smaller carbohydrates that are used to build polysaccharides. But these ones are officially polysaccharides because they're made up of many subunits that have been hooked together. And on the left, we have starch, which is made by plants. On the right, we have the animal version of starch, meaning that it's made for the same reason that I'll get into in a second, but this is called glycogen. A major function of your liver is to make glycogen. And what these things have in common, other than their function, which I still haven't told you, is that they are made of nothing but glucose. You don't have to use only glucose to build polysaccharides, but in both of these cases, every one of these subunits is glucose. All right? And this brings up why these two molecules, one a plant version and one an animal version, are of the same category. There are two major categories of polysaccharides, and these are functional distinctions, meaning the categories exist because of the way the molecules are used, what they function as. And the two categories are storage polysaccharides, and both of these are examples of that. The other category is structural polysaccharides. So let me first describe storage polysaccharides, since that's what this slide is. A storage polysaccharide is a polysaccharide that is built by the organism for the purpose of later dismantling it to be used as individual fuel molecules. Glucose is the master fuel for all cells. And that's not just in your body. I'm talking about all cells, including unicellular organisms, the one cell they have. Glucose is the main fuel in biology. And fuels are energy-rich molecules that can be dismantled to release that energy, or some of it. And some of that released energy can be captured and stored by the organism to do some cellular work. That's we'll focus on that process in Unit 3 after this next test. But that's what a fuel is. We burn our fuels for the purpose of obtaining energy for cellular tasks that require energy. And glucose is the main fuel. And I just told you that both of these molecules are really nothing but glucose, but they're all hooked together. Well, to use a fuel, the fuel has to be on its own. Glucose can't be locked up into a big polysaccharide. You don't use polysaccharides as a fuel. You have to first dismantle them into individual glucose molecules. But before that happens, the organism produces these storage polysaccharides to begin with out of individual glucose molecules, because at the time, the organism didn't need those glucoses as fuel. They shouldn't be wasted, though. They should be saved for later. But it's much more efficient storage-wise to hook the glucoses together, because you get rid of all those waters that come out. More efficient to store them as a polysaccharide, which you can later dismantle when you need it as fuel, than it is to store just a bunch of individual glucoses. That's a storage polysaccharide. And plants make starches. There's different kinds of starches, as you see here. Notice this one has branched. That's what I was talking about. There can be branch points when you build polysaccharides. We animals, though, produce glycogen, also purely glucose, but obviously, this has a lot more branches on it, so it's not the same polysaccharide. But the branching, by the way, has biological implications. Animals have a lifestyle much more active than plants, so they are much more likely to require fuel to be liberated from the storage polysaccharides quickly. And the more branches you have, the more tips you have where you can pick off individual glucoses, so you can get to that fuel a lot more quickly. In our version, glycogen. But they're both storage polysaccharides, because the reason that the molecule is built is simply to efficiently store glucose for later use as a fuel. And in your own body, you know, you eat a meal. Well, that meal, we say we put that food into our body, but we really don't. We put food into a tube, a continuous tube called the alimentary canal that goes all the way from mouth to anus. That whole tube is outside of our body. Our body wraps around the tube. And the digestive system secretes enzymes out of our body and into that tube onto the food to break the big molecules into small enough ones that can then be brought into the body. The absorption function of the digestive system is when we finally get the stuff into our body, into the cells. And then, when you get absorption after a meal, you're bringing in all kinds of glucose from the food, way more than you need at the moment, and your glucose level in your blood is going to go above normal. So, like I was talking about the liver, a big function of the liver is to take those individual glucoses when they're too high in the blood, hook them together to form glycogen for later use, and that takes them out of the blood and keeps the blood glucose level normal. But then, when it's hours since you've eaten, and your brain, which requires continuous glucose, it's almost the only thing it can survive on, as opposed to other parts of your body. It's using glucose continuously, and therefore, eventually, the glucose level is going to get too low in the blood if you haven't eaten in a while. And that's when the liver reverses the process. The glycogen that it made earlier can be dismantled into individual glucoses, spilled out into the blood, and it keeps your brain and therefore you alive. That's a storage polysaccharide. Well, let's go to 6 now, and you still have a storage polysaccharide on the left here, a starch. But on the right, we find an example of the other major functional category of polysaccharides. This cellulose molecule on the right is a structural polysaccharide. It also, by the way, happens to be made of nothing but glucose monomers, but it's hooked together in a different way and for a different purpose. Cellulose, even though it's chock full of glucose that could theoretically be used as energy, is not produced by the organism to store it for later use as fuel. Instead, it's made as a more or less permanent structure to form some sort of structural element. Okay? Plants make cellulose for various reasons, including to form their cell walls that we'll talk about later. Well, a little bit ago I told you that monosaccharides have two versions, a linear version and a ringed version, but there's actually more versions than that, because when you look at glucose, for instance, there are two monomers of even the ringed form of glucose. There's an alpha version and a beta version. And when you look at the structural formula of the rings, they're almost identical. They have the same formula, but the difference is this OH is below the plane here in alpha, and it's above the plane in the beta version. And since this carbon at position 1 has 4 different things connected to it, that means these are chiral compounds, and therefore they are distinct, right? You either have one or the other. Well, if you use a bunch of alpha glucoses to form glycosidic linkages, you produce starch. If you use a bunch of beta glucoses with glycosidic linkages, you form cellulose, which is a structural polysaccharide instead. And it's much stronger as a structural element, as we can kind of see in slide 7. One long cellulose molecule made up of many, many individual glucoses produces one strand, just like a strand in a rope, one of many strands that are running in parallel in a rope, right? Or a cable. So when you make a bunch of celluloses and have them run in parallel, it is forming a fibrous element. This is a microfibril, which is tough stuff. It has high tensile strength, just like a rope does. It resists being stretched. So this is not for the purpose of storing fuel. This is for the purpose of forming a structure. That's why it's a structural polysaccharide. In 8, this cow is eating grass, which of course is a plant, and plants are rich in cellulose. I just got done telling you that cellulose is made of nothing but glucose, and glucose is the master fuel. The problem is that we animals, including this cow, can't use cellulose as an energy source, even though it's nothing but the master fuel. And that's because of something I told you before. To use it as a fuel, glucose has to be on its own as a monosaccharide, not part of a polysaccharide. Well, we animals don't have the correct kinds of enzymes to break the glycosidic linkages of cellulose. We can't break it into individual glucoses like we can glycogen or starch. So even though it's chock full of energy in the form of glucose, we can't get to it. We don't get any nutritive value out of it. It's considered roughage for us and will pass through us. If we did have the enzyme, then we could eat cellulose, which is what you're writing on mostly. Paper is mostly cellulose. We would get nutrition from that because it's because of all its cellulose. Well, the cow doesn't have the right kind of enzyme either. It's a fellow mammal. But it does get nutrition from cellulose because in one of its four stomachs, it houses quadrillions of bacteria of a certain kind, and bacteria do have the correct kind of enzyme. This brings up something we'll talk much more about in the second half of the course, which is the link between DNA and traits. I've already told you, though, even earlier in the course, that DNA doesn't directly give organisms its traits, right? DNA gives organisms the ability to build specific kinds of proteins. That's what genes are. Instructions for how to build a specific protein. Enzymes, including the enzyme required to break the glucose or the cellulose apart, are proteins. No cell can build any kind of protein, though, including this one, unless it's told how to do so. Our body doesn't have the gene to tell the cells how to build that enzyme, but a bacterium's DNA includes that gene, so it knows how to build that enzyme. Well, this is an example, by the way, of symbiosis, which is more of a Bio 182 topic. Linguistically, this means condition of living together. Osis is condition, bio is life, sim means together. A symbiosis is a close relationship between two different species, in this case the bacterium and the cow. And even more specifically, it's an example of endosymbiosis, endo meaning within, because one of the two species involved lives inside the other species. And endosymbiosis might help both, or it might help one and hurt the other. In this case, it helps both of the species. So it's classified as mutualistic. It helps the cow because the cow gets the benefit of nutrition from cellulose that would otherwise just pass through it, like it does for us. Obviously, that's a benefit. And the bacteria clearly benefit. They live in a nice, safe, temperature-controlled, moist environment that with a continuously free supply of food as long as the cow keeps living and eating. Okay. Let's go on to 9. This just shows you that plants are not the only major group of organisms that produce structural polysaccharides. Cellulose is the most abundant structural polysaccharide in nature because there are so many plants. But they're not the only ones that make structural polysaccharides. This is an animal example. Chitin is a structural polysaccharide made by insects, for instance, to produce their exoskeletons. We have endoskeletons. Our hard parts are deep within us. Insects are soft inside, so they need to have plate armor, more or less, made out of tough stuff as a covering, which is what chitin is all about. And we take advantage of its strength by making surgical thread out of it. All right, that's a quick overview of polysaccharides. Let's go to the next major category, which is lipids. And the bottom of this figure, 10, shows you a fact. So I want to not forget and tell you right away that you should not use the word fat and lipid interchangeably. A lot of people do this erroneously. If you think about it in terms of sets, think of it this way. all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. There are other kinds of lipids besides fats. So it's a bigger set. And fats is a set fully within, it's a subset of lipids. Okay. This is the first of the major kinds of lipids we'll look at, though. And before we get to the full fat, let's look at the top to see how it's built to begin with. A fat, well, I'll get to that in a second. First, ignore this yellow thing and focus just on the gray shaded one, which is labeled as glycerol. If you didn't have this yellow thing, the gray thing just by itself, that would be a complete molecule on its own. It's glycerol. And what does the name glycerol tell you that it is chemically? It's an alcohol. Alcohols end in OL to tell you that. And what makes it an alcohol, or any alcohol an alcohol? A hydroxyl group. Well, it actually has three hydroxyls, so it's triply an alcohol. Okay? But remember that when you need to make bonds between smaller pieces to build bigger chunks, you need H's and OH's. So these hydroxyls are really three different places where a glycerol can be used as connection points with other molecules to build a bigger molecule called a fat. All right? Only one of those connection points has been made at the top here. So this is not a complete fat, but it shows you one of the subunits of a fat being hooked to another subunit of a fat. By the way, fat is just one of three different terms you can use for the molecule. These are completely interchangeable terms. Fat is by far the easiest one to say and to spell, but it doesn't really tell you much as a word about what's in it. The other words are triglyceride and triacyl glycerol. And which one is used, fat, triglyceride, or triacyl glycerol? Kind of depends on who you're asking. Triglyceride is what most biologists would call it, but they're completely interchangeable words. You can use any of them. Triacyl glycerol is what most biochemists would call it. But it's also, triacyl glycerol, the most descriptive as far as what the actual molecule consists of as subunits. Because you can see that glycerol is in there in the word triacyl glycerol. Triacyl means there are three acyl groups. Well, the acyls come in the form of fatty acids. Okay? So a complete fat, or triglyceride, or triacyl glycerol, is a glycerol connected to three fatty acids. So there's four parts to it overall. Okay? But what is a fatty acid? Well, you can see one pictured here. There's different kinds of fatty acids. This is just one kind shown here. Palmitic acid is the specific name, but you don't have to know that. Anyway, if you look at the orange shaded part, or whatever color this is, the fatty acid that's labeled here, how would you describe the fatty acid chemically? Well, almost. It's not, strictly speaking, a hydrocarbon, right? What's preventing it from being a hydrocarbon?
Oxygen.
And oxygen is part of what functional group at the end? No. It's a carboxyl. Remember that it looks like it's a carbonyl and a hydroxyl, but the whole thing is one functional unit called a carboxyl. So a fatty acid is a hydrocarbon tail, nothing but carbons and hydrogens, with a carboxyl at the end. Okay? And that carboxyl, with its OH, allows for connection to something else via a dehydration reaction. You can see that being made right here. The glycerol loses an H, the carboxyl of the fatty acid loses an OH, and out pops water. That's dehydration. And now the fatty acid is connected to the glycerol.
Okay? If you stopped there, that would be a monoglyceride, not a triglyceride, not a full fat. But there's still two connection points with glycerol, so you can add two more fatty acids. And if you do, then you have a complete fat, a triglyceride, or a triacyl glycerol. Now, there are different kinds of fats, but there's really only one kind of glycerol. So every fat has glycerol, that's the same. That's not the reason why there are different kinds of fats. Therefore, there must be different kinds of fatty acids. Well, I've already said this, that there are, and that's why there are different kinds of fats. I mean, yeah, different kinds of fats. Okay? Before we look at a different kind of... let me just say, there are two major ways in which... There are two major reasons why there can be different kinds of fatty acids. Okay? Before we leave this figure, can you tell me one reason... These happen to all be the same fatty acid. That doesn't have to be the case in a fat. A fat has to have three fatty acids, but they can be the same as each other or different from each other. These happen to be all the same, but can you, by looking at these pictures, think of a way in which they could be different? Yes. There's nothing saying you have to stop here at this methyl at the end, right? You could keep adding as many carbons as you wanted. So fatty acids can differ in their chain length, the length of their carbon skeleton. That's one reason why there are different kinds of fatty acids. And therefore, that's one reason how there can be, one reason why there can be different fats. The glycerols are all the same, but the fatty acids can be different. Okay, now let's go to 11 and look at the other major reason that there are different kinds of fatty acids. And this does not have to do with chain length, how many carbons there are, in other words. It has to do with how the carbons are bonded to each other. In the... Let me temporarily go back to slide 10. In all of these fatty acids, every one of the carbon-carbon pairs is bonded singly with a single covalent bond. Notice the single line between them. But that doesn't have to be the case, right? You know that carbon is tetravalent. It can form double bonds or even triple bonds, but it's possible for a double bond to form between two carbons, right? And that is shown in slide 11 as the other way in which fatty acids can differ from each other, based on whether or not there are any double bonds in the fatty acid, and if so, how many and where they are. Those are all variables. Okay? But, first of all, any given fatty acid, you should look at it and see, ask yourself, is there any double bond in this? Or is it only single bonds between carbons? We don't count the double bond of the carboxyl. That's not a carbon-carbon bond. Well, if there aren't any double bonds between carbons, then we classify that fatty acid as a saturated fatty acid. And if there is one or more double bond between carbons, then it's an unsaturated fatty acid. Okay? Now let me explain the nomenclature here. Think of your ball and stick models as we temporarily go back to slide 10 again. These are all, well, it's all really the same kind of fatty acid, but this fatty acid is saturated. What does the word saturated mean in everyday language?
High concentration of something.
Not only that, it means it's full, right? If something is saturated, it can't hold anymore. There's only so wet you can get a towel. It's saturated with water at a point, right? Well, here, saturation refers to the hydrogen atoms. So think about your ball and stick models. If you form a carbon skeleton of however many carbons you use, and you have only single bonds between each pair, then each carbon still has two more bonds it needs to make, right? For a total of four. and you fill those with hydrogens to satisfy the carbon valence. But if you just put one double bond between two carbons anywhere in that chain, you're going to have to eliminate some hydrogens to do that, right? So if you have one or more double bond between carbons, then the fatty acid is not holding as many hydrogens as it possibly could. In other words, it's not saturated with hydrogens. That's why we call those fatty acids unsaturated. Well, slide 11 shows you the structural implications of that. When you make a double bond, and this one contains just one, as you see here, that double bond position gets kinked. It's a bend in the structure. A saturated fatty acid is nice and straight. But an unsaturated fatty acid has a kink, at least one kink, depending on how many double bonds there are. And by the way, this explains why some fatty acids are called either saturated or monounsaturated or polyunsaturated. You see these words describing fats on nutrition labels. Polyunsaturated fats you see on labels sometimes. Well, this makes sense because actually those words apply primarily to fatty acids. But a fat can be classified as either saturated or unsaturated as well. A saturated fat contains only saturated fatty acids. All three of them are saturated. They don't have to be the same, but they all have to be saturated for the fat to be saturated. Of any fat that contains at least one unsaturated fatty acid is therefore an unsaturated fat. And a polyunsaturated fat is one that has multiple double bonds, either in the same fatty acid or in two or more fatty acids. All right? Okay, now, why does this bending matter? Well, what I usually use as an analogy is thinking about fatty acids as wires, stiff wires. And they can vary in their length, as we talked about. So you could have different lengths of wires, but they're all straight at first. Those represent saturated fatty acids. And if you kind of haphazardly throw them into a box, they will stack neatly, even though they're different lengths, side by side with each other. They'll get close together, in other words. They'll be compact. Much more like a solid, because solid has the particles, the atoms, spaced closely together. Okay, it's a dense packing without as much space. But now put a bend in each one of those wires, and the bend can be anywhere along the length. Now you throw those haphazardly into a box, and they're not going to stack together nicely, right? It's going to be a bunch of space between the wires. So they're going to pack loosely, more like a liquid than a solid. Well, animals tend to make most of their fatty acids saturated, and therefore their fats are saturated. And when we extract fats from animals for the purpose of food, we get things that are more solid at room temperature, like butter. Whereas plants make most of their fats unsaturated, and that bending in those makes them looser, so we get liquids at room temperature, oils instead of butter. And that also has, it's not just for food, it has implications when it comes to membrane structure, which I'll get to in a minute. That really doesn't have anything to do with fats, but a similar molecule that we are now at, slide 12. So we're still in the lipids section, but this is a totally different category of major lipids. This is not a fat molecule, even though it's pretty similar. The reason it's similar is that you have a glycerol here, same as you have in a fat. And as we talked about, glycerol has three connection points that can be made. You can connect three things to it. If you were building a fat, then all three of those things that you connect to the glycerol would be a fatty acid of some sort. Well, this has two fatty acids connected to it. That's why it's similar in some ways to a fat. But the third connection point for glycerol is connected not to a third fatty acid, but to a phosphate group instead, in yellow here, which hopefully you remember as a functional group. And therefore, this is not a fat or triglyceride or triacylglycerol. This is a phospholipid, obviously named for the fact that it includes that phosphate group. Well, it is really impossible to overstate the importance of phospholipids to life. None of us would exist, no organisms would exist without phospholipids. And that's because every organism is defined as an organism because of what structural requirement? What does every organism have to possess to be an organism? A cell. At least one cell. Every cell that's ever existed is defined by the boundary between the cell and everything else, which is the plasma membrane that defines the cell, the outer layer of the cell, right? Doesn't make sense to talk about a cell without the boundary, the plasma membrane. And every plasma membrane, even though they are made of different kinds of phospholipids, depending on which domain you're talking about, what kind of organisms, all cells that have ever existed have been made of mostly phospholipids. So without phospholipids as molecules to begin with, before there was any life, no life would have evolved. No cells would have formed. A plasma membrane is mostly phospholipids. And we'll have a chapter dedicated to just the membrane and its importance. But you can't make a membrane without phospholipids. And that's why when I talked about functional groups, I told you phosphate is maybe the most important of all functional groups for many reasons. You can't have DNA without phosphate. You can't have ATP without phosphate. You can't have phosphorylation of proteins without phosphate. But you also can't have phospholipids, and that's really more important than anything else, because you can't have a cell and therefore the other things in the cell unless you have phospholipids. Yeah.
Is it always one of the phospholipids and then the two fatty acids?
Yes. Phospholipid always has connected to its central glycerol a phosphate on one end and two fatty acid tails on the other. That defines it as a phospholipid. But just like there are different fatty acids in fats, making up different fats, there are different fatty acids that you can find in phospholipids, and that's one of the reasons why there are different kinds of phospholipids. Now, a phospholipid is the whole reason this worked for life, the whole reason we exist, is that phospholipids are examples of special molecules that we classify as being amphipathic. Have you had this word before? The pathic part of that, like in pathos or sympathy or empathy, refers to feeling. And we're anthropomorphizing, which means to give the something that doesn't have human qualities, just to talk about it. The molecule doesn't have any feelings, of course. But that's what the pathic part of the name means. And amphi, what does that mean? Well, that's a good example of a use. Amphibian's an excellent example. Just like in symbiosis, the bi, as in biology, of amphibian means life. Amphi means dual or both. And amphibians are called that because they have a dual lifestyle. They live part of their life on land and part of their life in water. And similarly, an amphitheater, you might have thought of that word too, that has amphi, is partly indoors and partly outdoors. Okay? Well, amphipathic means having dual feelings, or in a sense, dual preferences. An amphipathic molecule, which phospholipids are examples of, is a molecule that is polar at one end and nonpolar at the other end. And the reason it makes sense to say that it has dual preferences or dual feelings is that in general, polar substances like to be around other polar substances. Nonpolar substances like to be around other nonpolar substances. But polar substances don't like to be around nonpolar substances. Which is exactly why oil and water don't mix. Right, if you pour quickly oil into water, it's going to disperse into small droplets at first, but you don't have to wait even a minute probably before those small droplets coalesce into one big oil droplet that's not mixed with the water. That's because the oil is nonpolar and it's trying to avoid contact with the polar water molecules. Well, here we have a molecule, an amphipathic phospholipid, that has part of the molecule polar and part of the same molecule nonpolar. When you draw any given phospholipid in cartoon form, you'll see this in any book that uses these, the cartoon features a ball called the head and two tails. The tails represent, obviously, the fatty acids. And fatty acids are, except for the carboxyl, which is the connection point, they are, the rest of the molecule is hydrocarbon. Nothing but carbons and hydrogens. And you have to think back to the chapter where we first learned about electronegativity. Carbon and hydrogen have very similar electronegativity values. Therefore, a carbon-hydrogen bond is an equal sharing. That's a nonpolar covalent bond. So hydrocarbons are nonpolar for that reason. Okay? Well, a word that we use that goes hand in hand with nonpolar is hydrophobic, which literally means water-fearing. Once again, we're given the molecule feelings. Doesn't actually fear anything, but hydrophobic means that it doesn't want to be around water. Because water is polar, hydrophobic things are nonpolar. On the other hand, the head is where the phosphate group is. And phosphate, as a functional group, is beyond polar because it's fully ionized, right? It has a negative charge. So it's even more polar than water is. It has no problem being around water because water has partial charges. And therefore, we call polar things hydrophilic, water-loving. The head is hydrophilic, the tails are hydrophobic. Well, that's just a single phospholipid. And when we discussed the Miller-Urey experiment, where they produced organic compounds out of inorganic compounds by mimicking early Earth's atmosphere. Phospholipids is an example of things that were created gradually before there was any life. These just accumulated more and more in the oceans until there was a lot of them. Well, still today, you can take trillions, which is just a small droplet, of phospholipids, just nothing but molecules, there's nothing living in it, and put those into pure water, nothing alive, and those phospholipids will automatically assemble into what we see in slide 13, which is a phospholipid bilayer. It's two monolayers. You have one monolayer of phospholipids standing side by side with their heads next to each other. And this is another monolayer. But the two monolayers are arranged tail to tail to form an overall bilayer of phospholipids. This happens automatically, and this is how the first cells came into existence. cell-like bags of phospholipids formed simply because of the fact that when exposed to water, the hydrophobic tails of the phospholipids are trying to avoid contact with the water. The way to do that is to assemble so that they're next to the tails of the other monolayer. Neither one is in contact with either water outside or inside the bag. But the heads have no problem being right next to the water because they're polar. So they're either in direct contact with the outside water or in direct contact with the inside water. That's how the first cells came into existence. You have to have phospholipids first, but those were created gradually. Okay. Truly important molecule in the history of life. Go ahead.
So is the phospho end of the phospholipid the entire reason why cells can do osmosis then? Because if it was just fatty acids, would it like not let any water through?
Well, we're going to get to that in more detail later, but yes, the reason that the picture in the previous slide, 13, is not a cell yet, or more specifically, the reason this is not a plasma membrane is that you can't have a plasma membrane of a living cell be made of only phospholipids, because if you did, some things wouldn't be able to get through the phospholipid bilayer. And some of those things in a living cell need to get either into or out of the cell for the cell to remain alive. So all plasma membranes have a phospholipid infrastructure. That's most of what it is, molecularly speaking. But there are also proteins and other things embedded in it in a complete plasma membrane that allow for those other things to get through. We'll talk more about that in a different chapter. Okay, now we're still in lipids in slide 14, but this is yet another major category of lipids that are important in biology. Do you know what this is? We've looked at a similar thing before. This is cholesterol. The slide I showed you that featured very similar molecules showed you estrogen and testosterone. Remember that? They look very similar to this because of what I told you before. Cholesterol in animals is the precursor to all the steroids. Not just estrogen and testosterone, but all the steroids that animals make start out as cholesterol. What does the word cholesterol tell you that it is? An alcohol. Notice it has hydroxyl here. In case you're curious, the word cholesterol is not only an alcohol. The ster part, like in stereo, means solid. Stereophonic sound sounds three-dimensional, or solid, for instance. And coal is another name for bile. So cholesterol means bile solid alcohol. But it's a major component of bile, which is the secretion of the liver, the largest gland of the body. Liver does all kinds of different functions, including making bile. This is the major sterol in animals. Plants don't make cholesterol, but they have similar sterols called phytosterols, which are aptly named because phyto means plant. And so cholesterol gets a bad name in the press because too high a level can run you into problems, as you, I'm sure, already know. But on the other hand, you absolutely cannot live without it as an animal. Animals need cholesterol for various reasons, not just to make their steroids of other types, but cholesterol is an important component of the plasma membrane in its own right, which we'll revisit later. This, though, is why, you know, for instance, I am vegan. I've been vegan for 8 years, so I haven't taken in any cholesterol in 8 years. But I can still have an elevated cholesterol level, clinically speaking. And why is that?
Because you make it.
Yes, I am an animal. I would die if I didn't make cholesterol. If you eat animals, you're making your own cholesterol and you're taking in their cholesterol as well. That's why it's easier to get an elevated level if you eat animals, but you are an animal yourself, so you're making your own cholesterol.
Where is it made in the body?
it's made in the liver as well. The liver does a lot of different things, but it's once it's there, it's made into steroids in various places in the body. And it's also in the skin. This is another interesting example, because vitamins get their name because they are vital molecules that we can't make on our own in most cases. So we have to get vitamins from our diet in order to not die, because we need those, but we can't make our own in most cases. But vitamin D is an interesting example, because we can make vitamin D on our own as long as we're exposed to sunlight. Cholesterol in the skin gets hit by sunlight, and that causes it to get transformed into something that's called cholecalciferol, which then travels to the liver and gets another hydroxyl attached to it, and that turns it into calcidiol, two alcohols, diol. And then that travels to the kidneys, or a third hydroxyl gets added to it to make it into calcitriol, which is vitamin D, the active form of vitamin D. And that then travels to the gut, where it does its job of greatly increasing the efficiency of absorbing calcium from the diet, which we can't live without. Okay, that brings us to 15. So we're done with lipids now. This is the first slide of the proteins or polypeptide section of the chapter. And I've already told you various times throughout the term already that proteins do nearly all the important jobs in any cell. And I've already told you that proteins are what give organisms their traits directly, right? DNA gives organisms the ability to produce specific kinds of proteins, but the proteins are what give the organism its traits. And you're stuck, even though there's no limit to the number of proteins that can be built, you're stuck with only a certain set of proteins that you're able to build, because cells have to have instructions for how to build them. And that's what genes are. Okay, well, proteins compared to the other three categories of macromolecules have a much wider range of functions, as this table shows you. There's many examples of each line in this table, each row, but each row is really quite different in function from the other rows. So there's all kinds of different functions that proteins have. Now, any individual protein has a specific function, but when you consider all the proteins, they have this list of various functions, and it's a wide-ranging list. Let's just look at these major categories. For instance, some proteins act as enzymes. Actually, a lot of your proteins act as enzymes. You have thousands of different proteins that you're able to make, which correspond to your thousands of genes. But a big fraction of those are specifically going to function as enzymes that we'll study in detail in the third unit. But enzymes are catalysts, which are chemicals that drastically speed up chemical reactions. So metabolism wouldn't be possible, wouldn't happen quickly enough to remain alive if it weren't for the help of enzymes. And that's a big fraction of your proteins. Structural proteins are just what the phrase indicates they are. They are proteins assembled for the purpose of forming a structure, just like structural polysaccharides are, but these are polypeptides instead. For instance, there's various kinds of fibers. Silk fibers in animals. Collagen is huge in animals. It's in your skin and tendons, for instance. It's tough stuff. So there are structural proteins. There are storage proteins, not all that many by comparison. We store energy in other ways, usually, either as storage polysaccharides, but mostly, and I should have mentioned this when we were back in lipids, mostly we store our extra energy as fat. No matter how the nutrient comes in as food, if we don't need that energy, because we're taking in more energy in the form of food than we need based on our activity and metabolism, then we're going to convert it into fat, mostly for storage. candy manufacturers love to take advantage of the fact that they put on their label no fat when it's pure sugar. It's true. There's no fat in the Jolly Rancher. But you eat a bunch of Jolly Ranchers and you're going to transform it into fat to store it more efficiently. That's because fats have a high energy density, meaning that a gram of fat contains a lot more energy than a gram of protein does. So if we stored our extra energy as proteins, we would have to be much bigger and therefore heavier to contain that same amount of energy that's being stored. And that would be harder to move us around. It would be wasteful. Well, there are some storage proteins, though, like egg white. That's a storage protein. Transport proteins. These are proteins that move things around. And there's a bunch of them in your blood, specifically the liquid component outside of the blood cells, but still part of the whole blood. We call that stuff plasma. And the proteins in there are therefore plasma proteins. And a bunch of those plasma proteins hook onto things and carry them around in the body. Okay, I have to stop. Sorry if I went over it a little bit.